You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcina.
And we are thrilled to be joined today by one of our favorite third Pelton brothers, someone who is always a font of knowledge about the Seattle Seahawks and the NFL in general, from The Athletic, our buddy Mike Sean Dugar.
What up, guys? How you doing?
Doing well. So glad to have you.
Appreciate it. As you guys can see, I'm at the parents' house. I explained to you guys why. No internet at my crib, but anything to be on with you guys, man. It's like
any length, above anything. And beyond. Tristan was not willing to go to our mom's house to record this podcast. Yeah. Had his internet put out. He was just wanting to cancel the whole thing until he came back.
There really is like, it's like, I would say I limited it to only two, but I really like, this is probably the third. There's like three people or shows that I'm like, all right, if I need to move some stuff around, I'll do it with you guys. You guys know I'll pull up in person if I need to. Jackson on Cigar Thoughts. If Jackson needs me, I'm on. And then my guys out in London, Adam and Stu on the Pedestrian Pod. Any of you guys hit me. If I got something going, I'll probably move it or whatever I can to try to, you know, hop on. So anytime.
Well, TBD's still on live podcast coming up here. But, you know, Tristan, take the note. You're either competing or you're not.
Yeah, I get it. We should do a live podcast, though. It was fun. It's been a long time, too. It was when the Seahawks, right before we drafted JSN. Right?
And Devin Witherspoon, yes.
And Devin Witherspoon.
Yeah.
You yachted over a pretty good part there.
A fun draft I've been thinking about in this playoffs, because, you know, they could have – I think I had a one mock where they took Jalen Carter and Nolan Smith, I think, in the same mock, which is what the Eagles ended up doing in that draft with their two first-round picks. And it's a fun kind of what if. Would you rather have JSN and Spoon right now or Jalen Carter and Nolan Smith? It's an interesting little – what if? I don't think it's the wrong answer for what it's
I'm
worth,
fine. But I am so fine. There was like a little bit of in our podcast Discord chatter about Jalen Carter, and I'm like, the combo of Spoon and Byron Murphy the next year, I'm like, I'm good with that as a combo right now. Jalen Carter's fine, but
Jalen Carter is good.
He's very good.
But so is Devin Witherspoon. So I think, yeah, both teams are happy with how that draft turned out, I would say.
Yeah, no, it was definitely good. And then Nolan Smith was kind of quiet his first year like JSN was. And then he popped this year. He's popping now. He's on fire. And Jackson, had 1,100 yards or something. So, yeah, it's an interesting team-building kind of preference thing. Because DBs are valuable, receivers are valuable, edge rushers are valuable, three techniques are valuable. You know, It's like all four of these guys could make a Pro Bowl at some point on the rookie deals, you know. And Spoon's already made two. So,
yeah,
Jalen's already all pro. So, yeah, it was interesting draft.
And Pro Bowler over Leonard Williams this year. But
That's right. Yeah. So the Jalen thing is interesting, though. You get into some what ifs, because then you're like, do they still trade for Leonard? You know, probably not, because even if you lose Chenna, because I think he got hurt, which is what necessitated the Leonard trade.
Yeah.
Well, you already have Jalen Carter, you know. So that would have been – you probably don't need Leonard, but then it's like – well, you have this all-pro defensive tackle already on a rookie deal. Leonard makes like $21 million a year. So kind of big, interesting what-ifs there. And then Nolan is just a dog. Georgia and like actual good player.
Yes. I was talking about that on Saturday after Kelsey Plum got her jersey retired, because she loves barking. And it's like, if she had gone to Oregon, would she be quacking all the time? It just does not work the same.
It's not
a Husky or a Bulldog.
She barks? That's weird. I could never get...
She barked at Tom Brady, famously, co-owner of the Aces, in addition to his role with the Raiders.
Oh, he owns the Aces, too? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Good for him. That's weird. I wouldn't bark at anyone. I just...
What? Why did she bark at Tom Brady?
Because she was excited. She was fired up during the game. She was excited he was there,
Oh, it was like a positive bark?
Yeah, no, it's not a negative. Yeah, and she was encouraging the fans to woof during the halftime ceremony and afterwards. So, yeah.
Fair enough. We can
but that is
that
not.
Mike, Sean here. Yeah.
Weird.
Too much woof talk. It's not going to happen.
That's fine. I can respect all good players. I remember people thinking that when I was like, the Seahawks be bugging if they took Penix. It was like, the, you know, anti-Husky. Hey, I was like, I like Mike Penix. You know, cool, seem like a cool dude. Wears a do-rag everywhere he goes. I wear a do-rag for most of the when I do anything.
Costco hot dogs.
Black quarterback, which is always cool. I did my own like little quick wiki search, I think before the 2022 Apple Cup. And I think him and when him and Cam Ward went against each other, that was the first time there were two black quarterbacks starting in the Apple Cup, I think. We've only had three, so it wasn't that hard to look up. Just needed to look in the 80s.
It was. We only had three. Yeah, I mean, it was
We had two in, like, the 80s, and that was it. So I was like, all I got to do is look in the 80s, box score the Apple Cups, Google the pictures, and then figure it out. So, yeah. So I was like, that's cool. That's a cool piece of history, you know, for Mike to be a part of that. Cam Ward. Too. So yeah, I have some Husky hate, but it's really just on the Apple Cup. Like the other 364 days of the year, I really don't care what's going on over there, positively or negatively. It's like, it's whatever. Good for you guys. Although I do hate Jimmy Lake. That's the only one. I hate Jimmy Lake quite a bit. So
wait, is there a backstory there?
No, he just tormented us and then bragged about it.
Oh, right, yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I never met him.
It's funny.
Karma kind of came back for Jimmy Lake. So you might have won that one in the end.
Oh yeah. I knew he was never gonna work as like a he gave me very clearly like Rex Ryan vibes as like a coach. I was like, if someone puts you in charge, they're screwed. Like, you are not an in charge guy. You are like the cool uncle type, you know, show up at Thanksgiving smoking weed, bottle of Hennessy. Like, we're not putting you in charge of the macaroni, because then the macaroni won't get here, won't be ready, you know. He was never that guy, but he just tormented us. So yeah, he's the only like active, like, okay, no, I have a bias. I don't like the dude. Like,
Husky
yeah.
fans might agree with you now, long-term.
Yes, that was the only thing we can all agree on now. Like, yeah, Jimmy Lake.
It's so funny. We've almost forgotten like the amazing Jimmy Lake memories because things went so south when he was head coach.
Yeah. And I think he just got fired by the Falcons. I was like, Jimmy Lake defense. That's what you get, Raheem Morris. I wouldn't have trusted him.
The question is, does Ryan Grubb also fall into that category?
See, that was the thing last year with Grubb. There's a lot of people who thought, me and my co-host Chris Kidd, you know, the Seahawks Man to Man podcast, we weren't a big fan of it, of the hire. Probably me more so than Chris. And that kind of came off probably as like anti-Husky sentiment, you know. And I was just like, nah, man, like, I watched the Huskies. You can't play ball like that in the NFL. You can't. You can't. Especially not in this NFL. We're in this too high safety world. You can't just bomb your, you know, Roma Dunze and Polk and everybody, just not just going to run free. This ain't the Pac-12, you know. So, and that's it sounded like hate. It was. And it really sounded like hate in the face of like a very pro Husky like media contingent in Seattle. I was like, oh, it's Grubb. He'll be great coming off the natty. Meanwhile, I'm over here, you know, sound like a bitter Cougs fan. Like, I don't know, guys. That seemed like a pretty gimmicky offense to me. And it's just like, oh, okay, we'll see. And then, boy, that aged well. That offense was bad. It was bad. It looked like the Huskies' offense without the O-line. It looked like they were trying to do all the same stuff, but like minus Fontenot and all the other like good linemen they had. I actually felt bad for Grubb. I would have never hired him for that job. Too inexperienced.
Well, we'll come back to the offensive coordinator search later on the pod, but I think we wanted to start with something that maybe relates to the offense, and that's, you know, your reporting that internally at VMAC at the Seahawks facility that this season would be regarded as a disappointment, even though they won 10 games, dramatically exceeded their over under total, won more games than last season. That was met with some surprise, I think it's fair to say, by everybody on social media. So I really kind of want to unpack that and start with, I guess, like, What do you think that means? Because it makes sense to me that, you know, the expectations would be high within the building. But do you think that disappointment was a factor in the Ryan Grubb decision? Like, was there a feeling of something needs to change? Or was it just a kind of general, we could have done more sentiment?
I kind of view the Grubb decision just purely as a Mike McDonald thing. Like, yo, yeah, this ain't it. Like, what you want to do, Ryan, and what I want to do, we are clearly not on the same page. And it you can feel it, you know, during late in the season where Mike McDonald's like, yeah, we probably should run it more. And I think one day he got asked about like play action. He was like, yeah, our play action game is kind of good. We probably should do more of it, honestly. And it's just like, you just don't say those things when you plan on retaining the guy in charge of running the ball more and doing play action more often. I kind of view that independent of the disappointment of the season. And I think you're right. It was like, when I wrote that they failed to meet their expectations. It was like, oh my God, Mike, what are you talking about? They won 9 games, 10 games. It's like, guys, they fired Pete because they only won 9 games. Like, they only won 9 games. Like, you look at the other coaches that got fired when Pete got fired, they were all coaches picking in like the top 10. It was, you know, Belichick and where the Falcons were picking, and the Raiders fired their coach. And, or no, yeah, the Raiders fired their coach, had the interim. Like, all these teams, Chargers fired their coach. Like, all these teams that fired their coaches, Panthers too, I think, like, all of them were, they were rebuild, Commanders. Like, all these teams were really bad, winning 2 games, 3 games, 4 games. Like, it made sense. They fired Pete, not just because he was a bad coach. Pete's never going to be a bad coach. Like, it's too natural to him. It was like, dude, you only won 9 games again. Get out. Basically, that was a sentiment. You only won 9 games again. Get out. So, yeah, you hire the new guy and you get like a bonus 10th win. Yeah, no one in that building's happy about that. They expected to make the playoffs. They expected to win a division. They expected to make a run. Now, it's not just, oh, we didn't win the Super Bowl, we're disappointed. No, everybody's not that silly, you know? Like, it's disappointing when you don't get there, but like, every team's expectations are different. Like, the Lions right now, they won like, what, 15 games or something like that? They're pissed. They failed. They failed. They expected to make the Super Bowl and win it, obviously, but like, not even getting to the championship game is failure for the Lions. Doesn't mean they did good things. Of course it does. But ultimately, they had a goal. The standard was there. They spent a lot of money. They hit on the draft picks. They stuck through the times where they sucked. They did all the things to eventually like hit this trajectory. They got home field, which is great. And they laid an egg. And they did not even get to the championship game. They didn't make the Super Bowl. So that, for the Lions, I'm sure, without doing any reporting over there, I'm sure it's a failure for them. Doesn't mean like they are failures internally. Like, we're failures of people. No. You just set a goal and meet it. Simple. And in Seattle, I'm very confident that they're feeling the same way. It doesn't mean they're all like, we suck, woe is us, the Seahawks. But it is very much so. We had a standard here, and we did not meet our standard. You know, I remember talking to John at the owners' meetings in March. And it wasn't just me and John. It was Bob Condotta's there, and all the other beat writers are there. And I remember thinking, like, yo, so I asked him, like, what's up? Like, is the goal still to win the West and own the West? Because you remember when him and Pete got here, that was the thing. They were like, let's start. Own the West. Goal number one. And John was like, yeah. I mean, he kind of looked at me like, he looked at me the same way Mike McDonald looked at the at like Brock and Salk when they asked if Geno was going to be the quarterback. It was like, duh. What do you, of course. Like, John was like, yeah. He stuttered, which is why I didn't like release the audio, because it's kind of funky. But it's like, John was basically like, yeah, man, what do you think, we're tanking or something? No, we're trying to win. Like, our boss wants us to win. Look how they handle the cap. They like started adding void years and stuff like that and restructuring folks, like trying to win, you know. And they didn't win. Came close, you know. Doesn't mean they're all like in there like sad, like they got to fire everybody. But it's definitely like there's a sense of urgency in the building. John tells us every chance he gets. Which is why, Kevin, I was so shocked by people who were like, oh, they knew they had a first-year coach, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, are you guys listening to John? John tells us every chance he can get that he grew up as a Packers fan, wanting and wishing that every year the Packers did whatever they could to be in contention for the Super Bowl. That's what he wanted as a kid, that he wanted as a high school guy. And when he was an intern there, it's what, like, the type of energy that he was around. Like, every year we're trying to compete. So I don't think that firing Pete was like, all right, now let's take a step back so we can take a step forward. No, the goal was to immediately take a step forward. Should that have been the goal? Heavens no. But it was the goal. That's the thing. It was the goal to try to win. Try to win. At least, damn, at least make the playoffs. 7 teams get in. What is that, like almost 50% of the damn NFC makes the playoffs? It's like, you should at least do that. And they didn't. So I think next year, same standard. If they don't win a division, I'm sure some heads will roll, because that's the expectation in that building.
Okay, a lot of interesting things to unpack there that you said. I mean, first off, you mentioned, you know, John Schneider saying the boss, Jody Allen, that's what she expects. Like, how much of this do you think is sort of being managed up to her in sort terms of like John Schneider telling her, like, this is a roster is good enough to win, as opposed to kind of coming down from, you know, from the ownership level, whether it's Jody or Bert Coldy or whoever's involved there, and like, this is what the team should be doing?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I would imagine that John, like I said, with that Packers, like kind of anecdote with him, a lot of him is like thinking, yo, we're good enough to compete. And it makes sense because you go look in some of their games, some of the Niners games notwithstanding in the last like few years, they are a very competitive team. Like Pete had a really run there, but they never got their boots smoked. Like you could almost always every year they didn't get to where they got to, every year they didn't get to where they wanted, you could point back to some things that were just like very simple, like, oh, Blair Walsh missed a kick, or he missed multiple kicks, as the case in 2017, or oh, we, you know, Earl broke his leg, which happened in 2016, or you know, in 2017, Cam broke his neck, Sherm popped his Achilles, like it was just, you know, Cliff broke his neck, like it was all this stuff, like you can always go back, you know, a game here, you know, shoot, at the end of the 2018 or 2023 season, Pete could be like, yeah, if Jason Myers makes a kick in LA and we don't just goof up the end of the Dallas game, I think they had one more game they gave up at the end, like you could go back every year and like show how close you were, whereas the other teams can't do that, like the Jets, they can't just go back and like, yeah, well, if we just won a game or two here, you know, we're close. No, so like
Jacob
John
Hollister
sees them
gets
as
one extra
close.
yard, something like that.
Yeah, you know, like there's just ways that Seahawks can convince themselves that they're close. So I would imagine just from talking to John, hearing him, and she was on the radio like in the last two seasons, two off seasons, probably like 20 times talking about like expectations and his background and what kind of team they want to build. Like I'm not even like operating on a ton of inside information here. If you just only go off what John's saying publicly and take it at face value, which I tend to do because he's not good at lying. Yeah, they view themselves as a championship caliber organization. I think the only time that they were kind of like, I don't know, we'll see how this goes, is when they traded Russ. Because that was like, okay. Like you think about at the time of the Russ trade, they had no starting tackles, which was, you know, no starting tackles. At the time of the Russ trade, their only quarterback was Drew Lock. They didn't sign Geno till, I want to say, April, like a week before the draft is when they actually signed Geno that offseason. So you go like a month with only Drew Lock, no O-line really. You know, you don't have Ken Walker, who ended up being obviously a huge, huge bright spot. Your corner situation was kind of weird, which is how Reek and Kobe end up starting, you know. So like there was a lot of questions. I think that was also Clint's first year as the DC. So that year, I could see they maybe be like, oh, okay, we just let's go out here and just not embarrass ourselves. But every year, pretty much other than that, yeah, I think that comes from John. I think that comes from Pete. And I think, yeah, as extension probably comes from Jody. And I think the way that their like cap situation set up too has probably a lot to do with that. They're spending like a contender. They're usually up against the cap like every year. So I think that part of it probably is the ownership part. Like, yo, if I'm throwing, if we're not just rolling over a bunch of cap space, let's go win. You know, I think that's probably the part that comes from ownership.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that we've been talking about is, I think the fans, like again, like the Discord type fans who were paying a lot of attention, had fairly reasonable expectations for the season. The Seahawks probably exceeded expectations. If you were like 10 wins for this team that we went into the year with, people were like, I'm happy with that. My argument is basically this team isn't constructed like a rebuilding team. Yes, they're good young players, but
Correct.
there's an expensive older quarterback. There's an expensive older receiver at this point. There are expensive older defenders. And it's constructed fine, but when you say you don't think it made sense for them to have those expectations that they were expecting to make the playoffs, and they're constructed like a team that is not in rebuild mode, there's kind of a disconnect, and it seems like John Schneider has a perspective, and maybe the overall like front office has a perspective about where they are that doesn't necessarily match where the roster is overall right now.
Yeah, I think the Seahawks are probably one of, I would say, like three teams that have over the last 3, 4 years, give or take, has really just improperly assessed the quality of their roster relative to their own expectations. I would throw the Saints in there as well, and the Dolphins. I think those three teams are just like swiping the credit card a lot, like are clearly like, we're not gonna bottom out, you know, like we're just gonna just get the most expensive roster. If that means getting old guys that we got to defer years to, we're going to pay all our young dudes. We're going to pay all our old guys too. We're going to try to draft well. We're going to do whatever we can and just not suck because we expect to contend. Like the Saints have been doing that for the better part of the last decade. They finally, and they're still not giving up on it, I think. Like the Dolphins, same way, and the Seahawks are the same way. Like these teams are very committed, perhaps from ownership, GMs, to be like, we're not going to suck. That means I got to throw five void years on some whatever stuff or defer some contracts or restructure a bunch of people. We're going to do it because we're not going to be terrible. That's just not us, you know, and that's not the Seahawks. It's not the Dolphins on purpose. Like they're not good, but I think they've been around the same win total as the Seahawks too. Last few years, Saints have been shittier, but like they've had some quarterback issues since Drew Brees, but their idea is like, swipe the credit card, give Taysom Hill a 10-year deal if we need to so it can restructure it. Whatever they need to, give Kamara a 5-year extension, Lattimore, Cam Jordan. You know, Seahawks are built the same way. Let's just not suck. They spend like a contender. And I think that's all three of these teams have really mismanaged. Like, you're not a contender. You're not. That's why you're dun-dun-dun, not contending. Like, it's not a mystery as to why you're not getting to where you want to be. And it's just, and that's the reality of the NFL. Like, you kind of can't cheat the system in that way. The Saints are trying to cheat the system. The Seahawks are too, in a little bit. Like the Seahawks tried to, Seahawks did a really good job of cheating it in that, like, they got the high draft pick that comes with sucking without being terrible. Like this pick that got him Spoon was, whose pick was that?
Denver.
It had to be Broncos. The Broncos pick, right. Yeah, because the Broncos sucked, not you. Now, the Seahawks did suck for a year, and that year I think their original pick was the pick that became Garrett Wilson, which I think was like pick 10. So they did have a year they sucked, but like they were able to be okay in 2022 and then get a pick of somebody who sucked. The Eagles did the same thing. You know, they made the Super Bowl and had, you know, the pick that became Jalen Carter. So that actually is kind of cheating the game and still aren't contending. Like, that's not enough to tell you that you probably need to take that step back, you know, and rebuild it back up. You know, I think that's what needed to happen. And it's easy for me to say, cause like, I'm not the owner. It's tough. Everyone wants to sell hope. You know, it's hard to be like, hey guys, this might be a lean year. You know, it's tough, but I do think fans are generally like not that bright, you know, no offense, but I feel like we are getting into a smarter like fan era where it's like fans kind of understand over the cap or like spot track or like just that, hey, we're going to have to step back for a year. Like Commanders fans probably like, yeah, I'm like, we're probably not going to be nice this year. Now, obviously they are. They probably didn't expect it. Chargers fans too are probably like, eh, they'll probably be all right, you know, but I think fans tend to have more realistic expectations these days of like, we're not all going to, not every fan base think we're going to win the Super Bowl. You know, fans are a little bit more realistic than that, I think, these days. But the Seahawks as an organization are definitely not in the mode of, let's take a year, let's step back, let's clean our books up, like the Rams had to. You're like, okay, we got to clean this up. I think one year the Rams
made
had
the
like,
playoffs anyway.
Right, yeah, but that year though, they were, I think they signed like 40 UDFAs, I want to say. Like it was a, because they had no bodies. They had nobody on the team. Everybody had to be cheap because they were still paying people who weren't there anymore. You know, the Seahawks need to have a year like that. They don't want to have a year like that, but they need to have a year like that. And that's why I think, yeah, that what they expected based on their roster versus what they're putting out there, I'm like, yeah, that's, you got to be more realistic with yourselves. And that's, I think, a real big part of ownership is really looking at your team and being like, what's really best for the long-term health of our team? I think the Seahawks have kind of done a bad job of that last like 3 or so years.
It sounds like that's just not in John's DNA right now. From what you're describing, is that's not something that he's interested in. And when you look at the roster going forward, at least for this next season, I mean, we'll talk about this in a second, but it does feel like they're in mildly run it back mode. And hopefully the fruits of those picks that they got, you know, will pay even bigger dividends with JSN Spoon, players like that, Boye Mafe, et cetera. But like, hopefully that's the plan, is that those players pan out and they get that much better, but they're still going to have a 35-year-old quarterback either way.
Yeah. And everybody has expensive players too. Like there's no, for the most part, you're going to have like some guys who are making some money. It depends on who they are, what position. Like even if you have a really cheap secondary, maybe your D-line makes a lot, or your linebackers or whatever it is, you know? So, yeah, I don't think that's in his DNA. I don't think that's Jody either. You know, I think John has mentioned before, like in the press conference right after Pete got fired, he was just like, yeah, like we're trying to We're trying to take that next step, and that's a mandate from Jody. I know he used the words mandate from Jody in there. I forget what he was referencing their expectations for sure. I'd have to go back and read it. But like, it's very clear. Yeah, the organizational vision is to just remain competitive. Steelers are kind of the same way. I should have maybe lumped them in there too. They're like, well, I don't think even if they wanted to, you'd have to fire Mike Tomlin for them to like really, really bottom out. Cause like, I think he made the playoffs with like Duck Hodges or something like that. So it's like, okay, this guy can kind of just get you 9 wins with whoever. So he's probably, they probably have to fire him to do what they, if they really want to do a teardown, but they're very similar. Like, yo, we're not going to suck. We don't want to sell that to our fan base. We don't want to put that energy in the building that this is the rebuilding year. We don't want our coaches to feel that way. We don't want anyone to feel that way. We want everyone to feel like we're in this to win. And I do think there's something healthy about that from a mental standpoint, a recruiting free agent standpoint, a culture building standpoint. There are like real tangible benefits to having that as your identity of, as an organization. But then reality hits, you know, then by Martin Luther King Day, everyone's in Cancun. So like eventually you got to do, yeah, do what's right. You know, I think a good example of a team that really had that honest conversation was kind of the Vikings. And I think they won like 13 games in 2022, but then lost to like the Giants, I think, in the first round of the playoffs. They had a negative point differential that year. Both teams did, Giants and Vikings. And the Giants were like, oh, damn, we're right there. Coach of the year with Daboll. Let's go ahead. Let's tag Barkley, pay Daniel Jones. Let's get this thing rolling. And the Vikings were like, huh, I don't know if we can keep doing this with Kirk, man. Like, we got to change this roster out. We're not as close as we think they are. Even though they made the playoffs, I won like 13 games. They were like, you know what? That was fool's gold, you know? And that's really important. I talked to our Vikings writer at The Athletic, Alec Lewis, about that a lot because they basically accidentally won too many games. Really, they really did. Because that can really fool you as an organization. And the Vikings did not get fooled. They're like, yeah, we got to take a step back. Whereas the Giants were like, let's go. We're here. Coach of the year. Quarterback is here. Did we fix Daniel Jones? No, you idiots. No, you didn't. And now look where they're at. They had to bottom out, you know? So, yeah, I think the Seahawks really just need a year like that. It's not in their DNA. And I think eventually they might just – I think the downfall of that is like what you're seeing from the Saints. Now, what could happen to the Dolphins if some more injury goes the wrong way is that you're just going to bottom out on accident. And it'll be better for the long-term health of your franchise, but that could then people start getting fired, you know?
Or you get to the point financially like the Rams where it just becomes untenable and you're kind of forced into that situation, I think is the other scenario. But to go back to, you know, the surprise, the reaction from fans about the idea that the season was a disappointment, I think a lot of it was because of the fact that it felt like he was saying that hiring Mike McDonald was a disappointment.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think, you know, that was a fair thing to say, certainly. And I don't think that's also what you were saying. But, like, look, we're evaluating from the outside and we have certain perspectives, but you're in it every day. What did you see from Mike McDonald in his first year? How did he grow into the job? And how is it different from having Pete Carroll, who had all the experience in the world, to a first-time head coach?
Yeah, I think I should have framed my first article itself on that they had expectations in year one and then failed them. I still stand by that. That's 100% right. But definitely should have framed it more as like Mike was really put in a position, an unfair position, because he was put in the position. Like, you think how crazy it is to be like, hey, Mike McDonald, you're 37. You're about to be a dad for the first time. You're about to be a head coach for the first time. I need you to take over this organization and win more games than Pete Carroll, like today. No. If you are going to ask him that, you better give him a kick-ass roster, mm-hmm. like a top to bottom, like the Eagles roster. Give him that. Give him the Ravens roster. Don't give him this roster and expect that. That was really unfair to Mike. So if I had changed the headline, because I think the headline was an issue for a lot of people, because the contents were, I think, all fair and aged well. But it's like, if I'd have just said, the Seahawks failed Mike McDonald in year one, it probably would have been like a consensus, oh yeah, you know, because I think that's probably a better way to frame it. Because I do think that he just wasn't set up to succeed. Because I think he did a lot of good. He did as much as I thought he could possibly do, given the cards he was dealt. He fixed the defense. I expected him to. Defensive guy. Job number one. He got some hires right on his staff and some wrong. Makes sense. He's never hired a staff. You know, to get all of that right up the rip is just ridiculous. He was never going to hire. Everyone he hired this last year was never going to make it through year one. Like, even if Grubb's the only guy that doesn't make it, that's still, there was zero chance that everyone made it.
I mean,
he was not
it's
going to
worth
get
remembering
everyone right.
Pete Carroll changed offensive coordinators after his first year in Seattle, in addition to many other times, but like he got his guy who was there through the, you know, Daryl Bevel came in and was there through the Super Bowl run after being the second guy, because it was Jeremy Bates his first year.
Yeah, and even if you're not firing like a coordinator, you're probably changing like, okay, maybe this D-line coach ain't it, you know, or just quality control guy. You know, no staff is just the same year to year. You're not just going to hire everybody off rip right away. And Pete had to do it despite having already been a head coach twice, you know. He told Jeremy Bates hit the road, you know. So I think that I expected what Mike ultimately ended up doing. He honestly might have even exceeded my expectations. I had a feeling getting the OC hire would be tough. Because of when he was hired, I think he was the last coach hired in the cycle, either him or DQ. I think they were hired the same week. So that's just tough. Because by then, it's like, who are you calling? You're only 37. You only worked for the Harbaughs. There ain't but so many coaches you can poach,
yep.
You know, that you can pick up the phone and really have some history with them, you know. And I think in general, you look around the league, this is pretty consistent. When you're a young guy who has your side of the ball, finding your counterpart on the other side of the ball is typically a struggle, not just for Mike, but it's just like Mike McDaniel, for example. I don't know how old Mike McDaniel is in Miami, but if he loses Anthony Weaver this year to a job, he'll be on his fourth DC in 4 years. Like Anthony Weaver was already his third. He kept, I think, what was the first? I forget the first guy's name, but then he brought in Fangio,
yep.
Let Fangio go, and then not like Weaver's his third. Like, it's hard. Shanahan's been through a bunch of DCs, either because he let guys go or they got hired elsewhere. Shanahan or McVay, I think, is on like his third or fourth DC for multiple different reasons. It's just hard. It's whatever side of the ball you come from, finding the other guy is tough, particularly if you're a young dude without a big Rolodex. So I saw Mike McDonald make the most of what he had. I thought John gave him a bad roster. Like, what do you mean I need a center in August? Like, what? I should not be needing a starting center in August.
They shouldn't be retiring in November.
Right. Yeah. Well, that part, I don't know whose control that was in after Inklings, but that was crazy as well. But I don't know if I want to fault that on the process. But the process of needing Connor to start in August, it wasn't even a battle. It was like, you're signed, you're starting. I was like, what, bro? I didn't even know Gino. That you, no coach should be given that. He gave him two linebackers. I was like, I was very skeptical of those signings in real time. I was watching the film on Tyrell, watching the film on Jerome. I was like, yo, you're not about to tell me these guys are better than Bobby and Jordan. Even at the price points Bobby and Jordan got signed at, I was like, there's just no way. I would have just paid Jordan. Yeah. You know, it's just, and then what do you know? Neither one of them made it to Christmas. You know, it's like some of the stuff was just very predictable. And I thought that Mike got dealt a tough hand. I knew he would have to make some changes midseason. I was just like, this is not it. I was confident in like the edge room and I was confident in the D-line generally. I kind of feel they would get rid of Dale Taylor. He didn't seem like a Mike McDonald guy. But other than that, I was like, oh, okay. Your front, I feel good about. No idea what you're doing on O-line up front. And when I went to Nashville, I was like, yo, these guys are going to get Geno killed. When we went to the joint practices, I was like, there's no way Mike can work with this. So he actually did a good job based on what was in front of him. And I thought he did a real good job of like establishing just a culture of like accountability and meritocracy. Like he was like, yo, I don't care generally how long you've been here, how much money you make, where you were drafted. I'm putting you on the field if I think you can help us win. You know, I don't care about anything else. And I'll get you out of here if I don't think you can help us. Jerome, see ya. Daryl Taylor, see ya. Michael Jackson, see ya. Yeah, it's like, I'll get you out of here. Oh, Josh Job, you just pulled up off the practice. Come on. You practicing well, I'm going to reward you. Get in the game. Come on. Yeah, I know Derek Young, you've been in here for a little bit. But Cody White, when DK's out, I trust you. Come on. Come get in this game. You know, I believe in you. Come on. Oh, Kobe Bryant, come on. Rayshon's hurt. Come on, let's play. Oh, you're doing good? Rayshon, you're healthy? Sit some bench. That goes a long way, man. It goes a long way, that type of stuff. It just empowers everybody because you never know when you're – it just lets the players know that you're seen. You know, that practice squad shit is awful. Yeah. You're just doing all the same hard work as the regular dudes with no payoff. Like, literally, you're making a fraction of what they make, and you don't get to play on game day. You don't get to suit up, you know? So, like, those guys need incentive to feel like, if I do my part, I can help the team win. Because everyone just wants that opportunity, you know? Because those practice squad guys are not just, you know, bums you found off the street on like a Joe's versus pros type of thing. These are guys who were probably a five-star recruit.
Yep.
You know, the man in their college town might have a jersey retired at their high school. They're used to playing football. And you're asking them to just not, you know? So, like, I thought Mike did a really good job of making it clear, like, there is a standard. And if you do not meet it, I will get you out of here. And if you are meeting it, I will reward you, whether you're on the practice squad, you're an all pro, whatever. So I thought he did a lot of good things in that regard. I think, and I talked to some guys about it. And I thought he conducted himself really well with the players. Like, he let them know, like, just be you, because I'm just going to be me. I'm going to tell bad jokes. I'm going to be really, you know, serious. I'm going to be a hard ass on you. I'm going to tell you I love you. You know, like, he's going to do all that type of stuff, you know, and wants all those guys to do the same thing. I thought he did a lot of good stuff. It's the type of stuff that you would expect in year one, even if the wins don't translate. That's why I thought it was unfair. Like, you can't ask him to do all that stuff, get all that right, and hire all the right staff and go win. That's tough.
Yeah.
No one does all that in year one.
How much, I want to go back to the literally the first thing that you said, which was the quotes that he had about Ryan Grubb. So the quotes that he had about Ryan not running the ball enough, not using enough play action. How much, because to me, I look at it, it's like Mike McDonald's the head coach. He's literally the boss. I mean, John, et cetera, but he is Ryan Grubb's boss at that point. How much influence do you think he has on the offensive game plan? Or is he just turning it over to Ryan Grubb? And then also, like, Pete Carroll obviously has been doing this 50 years or whatever, being a coach. As a head coach, he's been doing it for 30 years or something. Like, Pete is very comfortable going in and fixing the offense as he sees it. Do you think Mike McDonald in his first season wasn't as comfortable going across the ball and being like, this is how the game should run offensively? Or was just kind of turn it over to Ryan Grubb?
And I think it was all collaborative. I think the whole thing was like, now I think what is different than Mike and Pete, their approaches are very the same. I forget when Pete told us this story, but I think he told us a story about how he learned very quickly about like not meddling with your coaches on game day. It might have been because he was meddled with when he was a DC, and he was just like, okay, I'm just going to leave them alone. There's a lot of stuff going on. I'm going to let these guys rock, and let's fix it during the week or whatever. Not to say you're just going to let them call a bunch of stupid stuff, but just in general, like, being a meddler was generally not Pete's philosophy. Now, I think the difference is with Mike had a lot more obvious blind spots because of just the youth. I think he's only been coaching since, like, 2013. So, like, how much troubleshooting can he really do if, like, his left guard isn't very good? Not to say Mike doesn't know left guard play, but you know what I mean? Like, there's just an intimate level. Like, Pete's been looking at left guard since 1972. Like, you're just going to know left guards a little better than Mike. That's the fact of the matter, you know? So he's been around a bunch of guards, a bunch of eras. And so I think that part, his blind spots are probably a little tougher in terms of fixing stuff. Like, I think a really obvious one, that he probably had to defer more than like offense, for example, it's like special teams, like just the coverage units and all that stuff. Not to say Mike doesn't know special teams, but like that's his bread and butter. It's not, you know. So I think there's a level of like just the lack of knowledge, institutional knowledge to really troubleshoot some stuff. Like it's a lot easier, I'm sure, for Mike to figure out like why they can't guard runs to hit the C gap. A lot easier than to feel like, okay, why does our right guard stink, you know, like, or something like that. You know, the troubleshooting part, I would imagine, was a little bit, there's more learning curve there. But I think the whole process with Grubb specifically is very collaborative. You know, I feel like Mike's signing off on everything that they were doing, like meetings on this day and that day, like when they, I don't know when they go over the final plan, whether that's Sunday morning, Saturday night, whatever. But I'm sure, I feel very confident that Mike was like, all right, this looks good, Ryan. Let's roll.
Yeah.
But there's still a level of autonomy that comes with that, particularly if you're committed to like leaving your guy alone, you know? And when I say leaving a guy alone, like from my understanding, a lot of head coaches are not like, and you can kind of see this on Hard Knocks and NFL films too. They're not like, hey man, run this play, you know, to your OC. It's more like, all right, let's eat some clock here, guys. You know, like tell your OC, yeah. All right, man, let's control the ball a little bit. Defense gas, blah, blah, blah. Or let's say, hey, we just got a big turnover. Let's take a shot here, huh? You know, like stuff like that. You know, like, hey, we got four downs on this drive. You got four right here. We're going to go for it if we get to blah, blah, blah. And it's instructions, an outline, a mandate, but not like a, hey, make sure you run, you know, Spider 2 Y Banana, you know, on this third and eight. You know, from my little experience in the NFL, it doesn't seem like coaches do that. And I feel like that's what people want Mike to do, like just to go over there, snatch the play sheet and be like, hey, right here, halfback dive, Ken Walker, go. And that's just not how the NFL works. You know, you really want to, because you want to feel like you hire those guys because they do know what they're doing. And Mike's a very big proponent of that. And that makes sense. I just think that I think what really did them in was very similar to what did Pete in with Bevel and Chadi. It was just like, yeah, man, that all sounds great until we run the ball on first and 10 and get nothing. You know what I'm going to do now? I'm going to throw it. I'm going to throw it. And it's really hard to get OCs out of that if that's like your default, you know, like plan to get those yards back, which is a lot of OCs. You know, the Eagles have had problems with that. The Ravens have had problems with that, you know, over the years. You know, their fan bases will tell you, like, we don't run the ball enough sometimes. We forget we have Saquon. We forget we have whatever, Lamar, whatever. You know, so I think that I think was the issue. It was like the plan could be great. Then you run a toss to Ken Walker on first and 10, your left guard gets blown up at second and 12. Who's gonna run it again? I wouldn't.
Oh, yeah,
You know,
no, neither.
I used to joke with Chad Morton, the running backs coach, all the time. He was like, man, it's on us to get those yards. Because we can't expect the coach to call, we can't expect Shane, like the OC at the time. How much expect Shane to call another run on second and 10? It's like, I wouldn't call a run on second and 10 again either. We're just running, you know, getting nothing. So I think that was probably the issue. Not that Mike didn't know how to step in. It was more like, no, the plan is fine. A, guys got to execute. And B, it's like, I still want to give my guy autonomy, you know, as I empower him because I hired him because I think he knows what he's doing. And also, C, it's like, hey, man, second and 10, second and 11, hell, even second and 9. Who's really sticking with the run game at that point, you know? And I think that was the issue. It wasn't that they weren't on the same page Monday through Saturday. It's like, get in there on Sunday. It's like, Grubb's like, hey, man, Geno's our best player. We're gonna have to throw this shit. And it just, you know, there's limits to that, the effectiveness of it anyway.
All right, well, let's talk OC replacement search. I think there's like a series of questions that hopefully you can kind of address and interact with each other. Number one, am I reading too much into the fact that when he was asked about it at his press availability after the Grubb, you know, firing, that Mike McDonald said he was, quote, involved in the Grubb decision, it would be involved in this decision as well, as opposed to making that decision. Number two, I feel like typically, you know, the expectation is teams are going to like hire the opposite of who they just fired. So the Seahawks fire Pete Carroll, one of the oldest coaches of the NFL. They hire Mike McDonald, the youngest coach of the NFL. Do you expect them to go for a more experienced NFL coach and play caller? And what do we make of the fact that like one of the known second candidates to get a second interview is Grant Udinski, who's someone who's extremely young, does not have any play calling experience. And third, do you expect there to be more candidates that emerge that we haven't seen so far?
I work backwards. Yes, I expect more candidates for sure. Then we know. I'm sure. What do we know? They talked to what, like five, I
Five,
think.
yeah, with Byron
Five.
Leftwich being the newest. The three who
I
we
didn't
know
see
they've
that.
requested second interviews with are Hank Fraley, the Lions offensive line coach, Clint Kubiak, the Saints offensive coordinator, the only one of these guys that has play calling experience, and then Grant Udinski.
Yeah. And that's like the baby face dude from the Vikings. Yeah. So,
It is very troubling if someone in their 20s becomes the offensive coordinator for the Seahawks.
Yeah, man, yeah, dude's what, 28, not a shred of facial hair on him. I was like, oh man, that's tough. I mean, I'm not like super, you know, scruffy, but damn. Yeah, I'm sure they've talked to more candidates. Mike's a very big, like, I think one of his sayings is like, a good idea can come from anywhere, you know, so it like a good OC can come from anywhere in theory, which I kind of always laugh at with like coaches, because like they don't hire women. It's just like, just you're
Yeah, not
literally
anywhere.
cutting off half of the population, you know. If you really feel like a good idea can, like if you really want an edge, go interview women, you know, like, because then you're the only one working with that pool. Like, you can get the best one. It's hard to find like the best OC candidate if you're only just working from the same pool as everyone else, right? But yeah, I do expect more candidates. I'd be surprised if they went with another person who has never called plays. Not to say they won't. I haven't had any reporting on it, but I would be surprised. Because I do think that was a very obvious blind spot of Ryan Grubbs that was like, like, duh, he's getting out coached in some of these games. He's never done this. So I'd be surprised by that. What was the first one?
Like Mike McDonald's backwards. Level of involvement in this coach,
oh,
in the
yeah.
OC search.
He hated that question. That's the first time I really see him not like a question. Huh. So, because the question kind of implied that like John made him hire Grubb. That was the implication. I forget the direct wording mm-hmm. of it.
Yeah, see, that's the thing is we don't see the questions. And I was very curious.
Yeah,
like
the question
context
was
the...
like, oh man, I wish I pulled it up. But it was like, and you guys can find it later, but it was like, do you plan on being more involved in the hire this time around? And Mike took that like, what you mean? I hire everybody. I'm the coach. It was just this implication that he was forced to hire Grubb. It was, I'm not even like critiquing the question, but Mike definitely did not like that. Like he was like, I was involved the first time and be involved again. Like very matter of factly, like, who are you to question that I, like, why are you even implying that I wasn't? He did not like that question. You could just tell by his face and everything. He was like, what are you talking about? You see me at Dino's? Like, you know, it's like, I hired Grubb, you know? So yeah, I think it was his call. And I really do think Mike tried to, bless his heart, he really tried to make it a meritocracy. He was like, I'm not going to hire a bunch of people like that just because I know them, or, you know, just because somebody I know knows them. I'm going to get who I think is the best person for the job. Like Mike did like the PBS Kids version of hiring an NFL staff. Like he would teach it like, hey guys, don't judge anyone. Don't have no biases. Just interview the best people. Go hire them. Great. Sounds great. Until you don't get the best people because there is something to familiarity in the NFL. Like I don't think there's a value in that. I think it's helping the Commanders right now, actually. That DQ did know some of these guys, players and coaches. So same thing with Harbaugh. I think it's no surprise that those two first-year coaches from this cycle had so much success. They hired guys they knew already, and they had done it before. Yeah. But yeah, I just think that Mike, he rejected the premise of that question so much that, yeah, if you don't have the question, it looks like, that's what was weird. Why he say he's going to be involved again? Because basically the person who asked was just like, yeah, so man, Schneider forced you last time, but this is going to be all you, right? That's basically how it. That's
it was
how it
almost
sounded.
Like they were trying to let him off the hook and just be like, "Yeah, Ryan Grubb, you don't bear the responsibility for that."
Yeah,
And I like the way, if hearing your description of it, I like that he's like, "I'm taking responsibility for Ryan Grubb hire." You know, like I don't want it to be somebody else. I'm the fucking head coach. I'll take responsibility for everything, positive and negative.
Yeah, that's another part of the culture that he did. That was really good. Like there was really not a lot of deferring of blame. It was really like, yo, this is our fault. Like, I think I remember one time, this was a Grubb thing, but you could tell this is part of Mike's culture too. It was after the Giants game. Ken didn't get the ball a lot. And he had like 5 carries. And then someone asked him a question that was like, yeah, you know, like there's a lot going on up there in the booth. You know, do you have someone next to you that's like even charting like the fact that like and hasn't touched the ball much, or like that this person hasn't gotten targets, basically kind of give him some rope, like, you know, in the lost in the fray. Like, do you even know that Ken hasn't touched the ball much? I think Grubb sniffed it out right away. He was like, yeah, thank you, but no, I know when Ken doesn't have the ball, or when Zach hasn't touched it, or how many times we've ran outside zone. Like, yes, he's charting all that in real time. If he's not doing it, someone's doing it and he has the info.
Yeah.
So like, but that was a very similar to what you're saying. Yeah, it's like they tried to give him rope, and it's like, no, the standard here is accountability for everybody. You know, Mike will apologize for making a bad call. You know, he did after he said he messed up the first drive against the Cardinals in Arizona. He's like, I really screwed up that drive. Thank you guys for, you know, making it right afterwards. You know, remember they gave up a touchdown on the opening drive. So, yeah, Mike's big on accountability in that way. I think he hired Grubb. I think he was on board with it, and I think that this time he's going to hire the next guy. He's going to be on board with it. Of all these guys, no one really moves me that much, but probably Leftwich, probably the guy I would probably go with, but none of them move me that much. But that, to be fair, it's really hard to move me because it's so hard to tell what kind of offense you're going to run.
Yeah.
You know, like I saw, I think this was like Dan Orlovsky the other day was like citing the Lions play action usage and ascribing that to like, this is Ben Johnson's philosophy. Caleb Williams is currently not good at play action. This could be a, a messy marriage. And I'm just like, how do you know that that's that Ben was doing that because that's what he believes, or that's because what he believed was best for Jared Goff? You know, because now we've seen two coaches run a play action heavy offense for Goff. Maybe that's just a Goff thing. Maybe he'll get to Caleb and be like, oh, you stink at play action. Your footwork's bad. Shotgun it is, buddy. You know, like it, just because someone did a thing somewhere else, it's hard to parse like, okay, what is what that's because that's what he believes, or that's because what he believed was best for that situation. You know, because if I'm Grubb, the first thing I'm asking, like a Kubiak who ran a, like an outside zone under center scheme in New Orleans, I'm like, okay, what's your plan for our roster?
Yeah.
Because if he tells me that, like, you're going to run, oh, see what I ran with Derek Carr and them in New Orleans? I'm just going to do that, but better. I'd be like, all right, get out. that's not here. Like, Geno is a different quarterback than Carr, you know? Unless, and then Kubiak says, well, I'm going to also, we're going to get a different quarterback. Then maybe we talk, but it's like, run that with Geno. I'd be like, no, get out.
Yeah.
You know, so. It's really hard. I feel like we assign all these things and like, oh, he worked for this person, so he'll do this. Like, I've worked for people before, and if I was in charge, I wouldn't have done half the shit they did. You know? I'm sure we all have bosses like that where it's like, yeah, this person likes this way. He likes the shelf stock like this, or like this computer program, he likes to download it this way, or like he likes to run his meetings this way. But put me in charge, I wouldn't do none of that just because I work for that person, you know? So without Tristan, getting them in the room is tough.
Tristan would run a podcast totally differently if he was a judge.
I mean,
Grubb is sort of an interesting example of that, because one of the biggest confounding things about last season was that his UW teams used motion in, you know, and obviously Kalen DeBoer was a big part of this, but like used motion to create matchups. That was a key part of their success. And then we saw relatively very little of that with the Seahawks. That was a little confusing. But to move us forward, I mean, I think the two big issues for the Seahawks this offseason are how to handle the futures of Geno Smith and DK Metcalf. I don't think, you know, you talked about the four options with Geno Smith. It doesn't seem like there's a realistic world where they cut either of those guys. Plausibly, they trade them. Plausibly, they extend them. They also could just try to go into the season with them in the last year of their contracts. And it's that last scenario that I'm most interested in, because I think when you pose this to most people, they're like, well, yeah, obviously they should, you know, run it back and then figure it out after the year what sort of the next contract looks like, especially given, you know, they'll have tons of cap space in 2026. The issue that potentially creates is, well, what if either of those guys is unhappy with it and starts threatening a holdout? So do you have any sense of the possibility of that and how that might affect kind of the discussions on extension or play out the season?
Yeah, I'm sure both of those guys would be upset if you told them to like stand pat all through the offseason, all through like training camp and everything. I'm sure they both would be pissed. I think John's done, he's been around the block enough that like, so.
Exactly.
Told Cam Chancellor, kick rocks.
Definitely Marshawn. Told a bunch of better players than Geno Smith that they weren't getting extensions.
Yeah, you know, like it's just, I think he'd hold firm better than as good as any GM there is in the league at holding firm. Whether he should or not is whatever, but I'm sure he would. And I think he would know, just like we all know, and I know for sure, ain't no way in hell DK Metcalf and Geno Smith are not going to play ball. Like Geno as the quarterback, you kind of just can't afford to hold out anyway. No quarterbacks do that. But DK is a competitor. He loves to compete. His dad is a NFL player, you know, and a lineman at that. You got to love ball to play on the old line. So when they're week one, whoever they got, DK is going to be out there, new contract or not, you know. And I know John would feel comfortable calling the bluff or whatever. Not to say, you know, DK, go ahead, got speed if you want to try it, but we know you, man. Like, honestly, I guess I would have said the same thing about Cam Chancellor, but I mean, shoot, he lasted what, two games, you know, yep. And those two games killed him. He was like, oh my God, this sucks.
Unfortunately, kind of killed the Seahawks defense.
I was looking at that season not too long ago. It was crazy. Like, it was the perfect storm of bad things. Like, Cam's replacement gave up the game winning touchdown in the Rams game.
Yep.
Then they go to Green Bay, like, get their boots smoked on national TV. And then as soon as Cam comes back, they shut out the Bears. Literally didn't give up any points the very next week. Kind of funny. But yeah, I would extend both of them. I would imagine that both of their representatives come asking for extensions, DK and Geno, because of what we were talking about before. Because I do think if you were to punt on Geno and DK, either one of them, but particularly if you do both, I think you are signaling that step back that they're afraid to take. I think it's much easier to take a step forward if you extend them. Because you can get out of some money, you know, especially if your owner is like, what is dead money? You know, because every owner doesn't view dead money the same. Because dead money is really money I'm already paying you. It's like, that's the way that it should have a different name, because I feel like it scares fans with the name it has now. Like, dead money is just, I'll pay you this no matter what. Whether you're on the team, whether you work at Kinko's, whether you play for the Saints, you're getting this money from me somehow. Some owners are more cool with that than others, right? So, and they all got cash, so it doesn't really matter that much. So I just say, let's say they trade DK. It's like, it'd be hard to sell that you're not taking the step back. You know, it just would be. And same thing with Geno. You know, so that's why I think it would make most sense to extend them. I think where you could run into an issue is, I think with DK, the last extension kind of showed that it's very easy to reach a middle ground. If you remember, DK didn't get one of those like market resetting joints. I think when he signed, by average per year, he was like the sixth highest paid receiver or something like that. I think if you gave him that now, which I would probably go ask for if I was him, if you gave me that now, I would think he was like, that's like the Jalen Waddle deal. You know, like if DK goes in the office and says, hey, can I have Jalen Waddle's contract? If you're the Seahawks, who would you be like, nah, man, too rich for our blood, you know? I'd probably do that. But like, if you're getting rid of Geno, that's insanity with no real plan. But I do think the issue they could run into with Geno is like, Geno's made it very clear he thinks he's a very good quarterback. Like,
an elite quarterback.
One of the best. Yeah, like one of the best, you know? That costs, that's how you get a gap. Like, Geno didn't have much leverage last time because it was like, okay, are you like lightning in a bottle, first year as a starter since, you know, the Cold War? Like, are you really that nice? Well, now he's got a 3-year sample, 2 Pro Bowls, lots of film. He's older, obviously, but like, he has a lot more, I think, to argue like, guys, I just saw one-legged Kirk Cousins get a bag.
Exactly.
Kirk's my age. I'm better. I have 2 legs. That's where we start these discussions. Like, and I think, and that's really low ball, honestly. Like, Geno played as well as guys who are making 50 mil. Now they're younger, but I think that would probably be the only potential holdup, is the gap in how Geno sees himself versus how the Seahawks see him. Now, with that in mind, I asked Geno that. That's actually the last question of his Rams press conference at the end of the year. I asked him, I said, are you confident the Seahawks view you the way you view you? He said, yes, I am. And then he walked off. Not like angry, walked off. That was just the last question.
Dropped the mic, just walked off.
That's a really important part of this. Like, because if Geno thinks he's like a top 10 quarterback, I think a top 10 salary right now is Kyler Murray's contract. It's like $46 million a year. So even if he thinks he's like top 12, you're probably looking at like 44 or something like that, 43, Kirk's deal, you know? So I think that could be a hiccup, because, I mean, I'm taking Geno at his word. I'm sure they agree, you know, but I really should have specified when I was walking away from that press conference. I was like, God damn it. I should have said, are you confident John Schneider sees you that way? Because I'm very confident Mike McDonald sees him that way for sure, but he don't cut your checks, you know? So I do think the best path is to keep both of them if you want to contend. If you really want to take that step back here, whatever, go punt on both of them. Get whatever you can. But if you really want to try to push this thing out, swipe the credit card, convince yourself you're a contender, you keep them. And I think that means, yeah, you give Geno a cap-adjusted version of Kirk's contract. You give DK the Waddle deal, and you trim some fat, and you go out there and you try to put the best roster you can. You know, I don't think you can try to be a contender and move on from either one of those two guys.
I think you plausibly could with DK. I agree that Geno, it's synonymous with rebuilding. I mean, obviously they could argue that they've done this successfully with him, but certainly I don't think that's going to happen with Sam Howell is stepping in the same way that Geno once did.
They also look at the assets too that they got from Russ.
I think that the DK one is tricky for me, because I don't even care about, like, the process of trading a DK makes perfect sense, but it's just the do I trust John to do the execution part? Like, if you tell me, hey, I'm going to get a, like, I think the comp for DK, I don't know if this would what happened, but like he's about the same age and the same level of production that Stephon Diggs was when he got traded to Buffalo. Almost the exact same age, I think. And he got a first round pick and more, you know, the Vikings got. They immediately drafted Justin Jefferson. Great. That sounds great. There have been a plenty of other receiver trades to show us it don't work like that. It don't. You go ask the Titans if it works like that. You know, go ask the Packers if it works like that. They still need a number one receiver. You know, they don't. They're out here making, their fans are out here making T. Higgins photoshops because they're hoping they go pay him. You know, it's not working for them. Buffalo even traded to Diggs and was like, damn, we could use another guy, huh? Let's go get Amari Cooper. You know, like even the Chiefs keep trading for receivers, not first round picks, but go trade for Kadarius Toney, go trade for D Hop, trade up for Xavier Worthy. Like it's not just as simple as, okay, let's just the college game is producing all of this ready to go guys, so we can trade our expensive dude and go draft another ready to go guy. We see too many teams have not been good at doing that. The Vikings, I think, are probably the best, most recent example in this like age where the receivers are ready to roll so fast. Everyone else is pretty much struggling with replacing that guy right away, you know? So, yeah, it makes sense. If the Chargers call you right now and give you a pick, what do they have? 22, 23? Chargers call you right now. Say, hey, we're tired of Herbo throwing a Quentin Johnston. Here's a first round pick. Take DK. That sounds great. Until you use that pick on Treylon Burks, then you get fired. You know, it's like it's the execution that I'd have more skepticism about. But you're right. You can sell that, okay, we're not totally tearing it down, but it's like at that point, my next level of apprehension is like, do I trust you to find your Justin Jefferson? You know, because if you're not trying to compete, if you are trying to compete, I do need you to find that. It's not just, okay, let's take a step back if we don't have DK. It's like, okay, no, you said we could be fine without him. Go get me another receiver then.
Yeah, I'm doing that trade if it's offered. And I
I agree,
don't think DK
but
was because and the reason is the difference between him and the Seahawks and those teams is DK probably isn't their number one receiver at this point. I think JSN has ascended to that status.
that's a good question. I'm not sure. It's an interesting one because DK dictates coverage like a number one, which is like, yeah, it gets kind of sometimes the other guy can outproduce if you don't use the number one, right? Like if you let them dictate the coverage too much. So, yeah, I don't think the Chargers would offer that. But let's say that's basically the Diggs trade. I think Justin Jefferson was pick what, 21 or something. It's almost exactly the same. I don't know why the comp would be different. Maybe teams just don't want to do that no more. But like even if the Patriots were like, we'll give you our first second round pick, which is probably what, pick 34 or something like that. Cool. Are we trusting John to go reallocate that to go get you the right guy? I don't know.
can I get Jalen Polk?
Oof. Oh
I don't know if
man.
we want
In
Jalen
the
Polk.
second
But
round pick, to be clear.
the okay. Yeah, there we go.
Receiver room's pretty thin if a trade like that happens.
And especially with Tyler obviously getting older. But what do you think? I hope you didn't talk about this while I was off. What do you think the chances are that the Seahawks go out and draft a quarterback? Maybe not a replacement for Geno Smith the second necessarily, but a second round pick, a third round pick, somebody that they can develop, or do they view Sam Howell as that guy?
I think yes and yes. They do view Sam as that. Sam's pretty young. I think he's younger than Jaden Daniels, younger than Michael Penix, probably younger than Bo Nix. All these guys were in college forever, so it makes sense. Bo was there for he Bo probably has so many degrees. He was in college so long. It's crazy. Jaden Daniels too. He's in college forever. He threw to like Brandon Ayuk. It's like, bro,
I
what?
mean, Penix was also 6 years, yeah.
Yes, yeah, that's crazy. Anyway, yeah, they do view Sam as that guy, which makes sense. He's young, he's cheap, you know. But I think every year John's gonna draft a guy and he proves me wrong every year. I don't know what it's gonna take. There's so because at this point we kind of know what John likes. He basically likes a halfway athletic, strong arm guy who's a little reckless. Basically, like if there was like an evolution chart of from Brett Favre, kind of we have like the caveman to the monkey to the man type of thing. If we had one of those, whatever the so Favre is at the far end, like the primate, and like whatever like evolves to that, I guess the end of it would be Josh Allen.
Josh Allen, yeah.
Yeah, but whatever's in the middle there is like what John really loves. Like, man, look at that guy. I got a live arm, tough as nails. Like he says the same things when he describes like his dude. Like, he just loves that. And there's been that in the draft, not even at the top. It's just been guys. Like, I was very surprised he did not draft Spencer Rattler. I was like, dude, how do you, this, his arm's live as hell. You know, a little erratic, but like, he's got a cannon. Tough dude. I was just like, how's that not your guy? You know, didn't take him. There's been a few guys over the years like that. Howell's not one of them, but like, there's just been some other dudes in the draft where I'm like, damn, John, you didn't roll with that, huh? Like, this is you. This is your MO of like guys that you like, tough, whatever, you know, strong arm. Cause John don't really care about interceptions like that. You know, grew up around Favre. Maybe that's what it is. Like, Gino led the league in interceptions before, I think, or just had a shit ton of them. Sam led the league in interceptions. He's like, yeah, I don't care. I think Drew Locke led the league in interceptions in 2019 or 2020. So like, he just don't care. Because if you're just kind of halfway mobile, strong arm, white dude or black dude, don't care. You're just like, come on over. You know, so I think every year he's going to take a guy because there's that type of profile damn near every year, other than like the 2022 draft had nothing other than Purdy. So, yeah, I expect him to take one. But then again, I expect him to do that literally every year.
Has he drafted? He's drafted. I guess he's taken some seventh round quarterbacks.
He's taken two quarterbacks ever.
Two quarterbacks ever. Just David Green and Russ?
Now, Russ and Alex Magoo.
Right. Oh, Magoo.
Yeah. Okay. Florida International, I think, or Florida Atlantic or something.
Still kind of like him.
Yeah. Right now, Alex Magoo is just a really obscure trivia answer for now, as the only other quarterback the Seahawks have drafted. But there's been guys like that. In these later rounds, that, you know, even Levis was kind of like that too. It's like strong arm kid, tough as hell, and just kind of a crash dummy, perfect John quarterback. You know, didn't take him. So yeah, I think he's gonna take one. But I think I think that literally every year.
Geno Smith did not lead the league in interceptions at any point with the Jets. Let's see where he finished, but. But he never finished higher than actually this season was his highest finish with third.
Definitely,
I guess he just didn't throw enough passes during his Jets days to do that. But
you know what? That's what it was. He had more interceptions than touchdowns coming into his first year as a starter. That's what it was. He had thrown a lot of them. He had like, forget what it was, but coming into 2022, he had thrown more interceptions than picks or interceptions than touchdowns. That's what it was. He did not lead the league. You're right.
21 interceptions as a rookie, 12 touchdowns, but both Drew Luck and Sam Howell did in fact lead the league in interceptions.
Yeah. John don't care, man. Come on. You can sling it. Come on down.
Pete did care, as it turned out. But
Pete was a very big protect the ball guy. Yeah.
I was going to ask a question about that because the Seahawks turnover rate did go up from 2023, but then I looked at it and it actually was higher in 2022. So I don't know that we can attribute that to Pete Carroll not being around telling guys not to protect the ball. To wrap up, we're going to go through the same exercise that we did with your buddy Ben Baldwin on our season recap podcast, which is an off-season preview, which is looking at the chances of returning for a shorter list this year of key players whose return are in question to some degree. We'll start after we've had this entire conversation with Geno Smith.
What am I putting a number on it? Like 1 to 10? Or
1 to 100.
1 to 100? Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah, 1 to 100. Oh, this is real high. I would say like just returning, being on the team.
Yep.
Oh, like 99. I feel very confident about that. I'd be very surprised if he was gone.
Someone we've not talked about during the podcast, Tyler Lockett, who, you know, surely will not be on the team at the same salary, but potentially at a different one like last year.
Yeah, this one hurts, man. I love Tyler, man. Like, he's just a really good dude. But this is a real low. I'd say like 10%. The number is just a no-go. It's like 30 million or something like that.
Right.
But also just John has just shown just very little regard for sentiment in these instances. Mm-hmm. It's like Sherm played like 100 games in a row, gets hurt one time. He's like, see ya. You know, KJ, who else did he let walk?
Bobby twice.
Yeah, Bobby twice. Like, you can be a good dude, you know. Is he just do not care if the money don't. Bobby, he ain't even, to my knowledge, I know Bobby said this at least once, they ain't even offer him, like, one of them, like, cuts or something like that. Or like, hey, let's bring you back. It was just like, nah, man, just go. No renegotiation, just go. And I'm like, if he could do that to Bobby twice and KJ, I'm like, yeah, dog. He's probably not treating Tyler any different. So I'd probably say like 10%.
DK.
Feel pretty good about this too. I'd say like 80.
That actually
I feel
is
really
tied.
Strong about that.
That's actually tied for our lowest with me. Tristan was at 100 on that one.
Yeah, I mean, the only reason I can't say 100 because, like, you're right. You can still sell that we're going for it if you get rid of them, particularly if the comp is good.
Right.
If the comp is good. Yeah, if the comp is – if like, the Chargers call and, like, hey, we will give you 20 – shoot, the Patriots call and say, hey, we'll give you whatever. Panthers call. I think they're cool with the Panthers GM. Yeah, he used to work here. So, yeah, I do think there is a world where – kind of get those offer you can't refuse type of thing. I don't think it's likely, which I'm going 80%, but I mean, John listens to everything. I remember the reason I knew they were going to trade Russ, I kind of knew for a while, but when I really knew was at the combine that year. And John was like, so remember, I think I asked Pete, someone asked Pete on the podium. It was like, when people call you, this was me. I said, when people call you and ask you about Russ, what do you say? And Pete was like, we tell them we're not trading the quarterback. I was like, great. Or it was like, we have no intention of trading the quarterback, I think was the exact phrase. I was like, oh, that's great. Good answer. And John was like, I asked him something similar in the hallway in an on-record interview. And he said something to the effect of like, yeah, you know, he didn't say Pete's answer, which was notable. And the other thing was, he was like, yeah, when people – I was like, why do you even take the call if you're not trading? Like, why are you even entertaining it? He was like, well, you got to take the call. You know, I was like, you got relationships in the league. And I was just like, I didn't argue with him, but I remember thinking, oh, Russ is out of here. Like, what do you mean you got to take the call? No, you don't. No, you do not. If you call Andy Reid right now next to Patrick Mahomes, he's probably calling the FBI on you. He's not about to entertain that convo because of his respect for your relationship. You know, get the hell out of here. Imagine, I don't know how much you guys have been following how much Harbaugh loves Justin Herbert, but he loves the ground that guy walks on. If you call Jim Harbaugh right now and say, Jim, we need Herbert, let's talk. He's going to talk your ear off about like climate control or something. He's not even going to entertain the thought. So when John was like, he has to entertain it, I was like, oh yeah, Russ is out of here. I'm like, John's lying. He's doing a terrible job lying to me right now. Like Russ is out of here. So I forget where I was going with that, but yeah, I think there's a chance that if you call John
for DK,
yeah,
I know he would take the call, and he's not going to talk about climate control if the number is right, for sure.
Noah Fant.
This is probably the tough, honestly, probably the toughest one, because he was so unproductive for reasons that seem so obvious to be out of his control,
right,
that have nothing to do with the talent. Like I watched Noah all year, all the film, everything. Noah was just same guy from when they got him. He moves the same. He's actually blocking better. I think losing some, I'm projecting on this part, but like I think losing his reps to Colby Parkinson late in that 2023 season seemed like a wake-up call, because Noah blocked his ass off all of 2024. Dirty work, dirty work, dirty work. And I would imagine the coaches see that. And it's like, you save like $8 million, I think, getting rid of him, a release or a trade. I'm just like, man, I can work with a 28-year-old really athletic tight end who's willing to block. Like, if that cost me 4% of the cap, which I think is what his number is, I can roll with that, man. I don't need to trim that fat. That not fat to me. That's healthy to me. So problem is to save at $8.9 million. I'll say about 65%. I think that when they watch the film – and they look at the tight end landscape and what he can do for an offense. If your OC is like competent, that you can roll with that number. Maybe that just means tacking some void years on to bring the number down. But I just think Noah just has value. Like Noah's like, yeah, he's what, like 27, 28. Like I'm keeping that guy.
That's two in a row we've landed on precisely the same number. Yeah. He's
really
27. Jaron Reed.
Oh, this one's tough too. This one's tough. Jay Reed's a culture setter. He really is. He holds guys accountable. He's one of those, if you're around, if you're around him, you feel why he matters. He also just had a good year statistically, but the reason why this is tough is because I just did a rookie review article and I rewatched a bunch of like snaps of Byron Murphy. And I was like, it was interesting that when Mike McDonald was assessing Byron, he was like, yeah, well, when he's taking a three technique snap, well, Leonard's not on the field. So, like he kind of created the either or like conundrum, right, was about Leonard and Byron. And I was watching a lot of their plays. I was like, okay, the issue I feel like is Jaren. I was like, if you want Byron to have a bigger role, that it means either moving on from Jay Reed or just telling him to swap, telling Jay Reed, right, like, okay, now you're Jonathan Hankins now.
Well, Jaren. What JSN and Tyler Lockett sort of did this season.
Yes. Which you can probably do. You know, Jaren's probably wise enough and loves Seattle enough. And he says he wants to retire here. He's probably mature enough to do that. Like, okay, my role now, I'm a Taba Rubin, you know, like I'm switching, you know? So I actually think because Jay Reed is probably mature enough to do the Tyler thing, I probably put that like 80. I feel good about that. What you probably just do is you let Jonathan Hankins go and you tell Jay Reed, okay, you're Hank now. You're the OG. You're the vet. Murph's the guy. We still need your leadership. Still need you to ball. But Murph's the guy. Because I really just don't think there's a way to get the most out of Byron Murphy while having him be like defensive tackle three behind Leonard and Jay Reed. Like that's just, I don't even think that's just good like football to do that. Like Byron's a stud. So, but I do think I think he'll be back.
Yeah, that's the highest of all of us. Uchenna Nwosu.
Yeah, I feel good about, I feel like 90. I feel good about Chenna. I just think you got to bring his number down. But also, I feel like, I think what's helping my perspective with that is like, Chenna doesn't have like a, like Jamal had a really bad knee injury. Like you see the brace that he was wearing at one time. It was like, bro, did they take your leg off? Like that thing was crazy. Alex Smith type of leg trauma. Chenna Torres Peck came back. Peck's fine. I forget what he did the other time. Quad, thigh, contusion, whatever. Rehab did, he's fine. Like if he was dealing with like a back issue or like a chronic knee thing, then I could see them be like, okay, dude, you gotta bounce. You're gonna take too long to get back to being the guy we paid. But I think he just had a bunch of unfortunate, just like regular football injuries, for lack of a better phrase, you know what I mean? So he's an obvious one that I would probably, I'd restructure that today if I could throw. I'm a big void years guy these days. I'm just like, we're talking about billionaires here. Who cares if you're paying Chenna Nwosu until 2030, you know? You want to win now? So yeah, I feel really good about Chenna being back, just not at that number. And I also think that Chenna's their best outside linebacker too. So probably should keep that guy.
Yeah, I think it'd only realistically be if they went that direction in the first round, you know, that sort of thing. Lastly, Ernest Jones the fourth.
99. I feel really good about that. I think that when the guy is a good fit, John is pretty good about keeping the dudes he trades for. I think the guys that he's let walk, it made all the sense in the world. Like Sheldon Richardson. Guys just didn't like Sheldon. You know, like players. There were some players. Not all. Some. Enough that it mattered. So then when it was time to pay Sheldon, they were like, no. We're not doing that. Because they gave up a second round pick for Sheldon. Like that was...
And Jermaine Kearse.
Yeah. Second and Jermaine. It was a really panicky move and reaction to Malik McDowell. Like I get it, but it was very panicky. And I call it panicky because it was just like, I underestimated. That was my first year on the beat. I didn't realize how much players value the reputations of other players. Like players will legitimately go to tell GMs or coaches, like, we don't rock with this guy.
Yep.
Like if they'd have ran the Jimmy Graham trade by the Seahawks players, they'd have been like, hell no. Keep Max. He's soft. He's not one of us. Like they would have said all that. They said it anyway. But like Sheldon would have been one of those guys. There were just cats who just didn't rock with him. Whereas Ernest and Dwayne Brown, Carlos Dunlap, Quandre, like those guys fit. So he made it a point to bring those guys. Like those guys were pretty, very well liked, particularly Dwayne and Quandre. Very, 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 very well liked. But then like Clowney, it was like kind of whatever, you know, so let him walk. So Ernest is like, I don't even know. I think everyone likes Ernest as a guy, like players, but there is a reverence for the way he plays. I don't know if it's just because they didn't like how Tyrell was playing or how Jerome was playing or something, but you can just feel it when they talk about these guys. It's almost like when a parent tries to lie and say they don't got a favorite kid, but then you ask them about like the youngest one and they're just like unintentionally lighting up and you're like, ah, yep, okay. Billy's your favorite. I can see it in your eyes. Like just watching like Julian Love talk about Ernest and run fits, you're just like, oh, you love this guy. Like you love him. And yeah, it's very similar to how they talked about Quandre, how they talked about Dwayne Brown. John's done a good job of not letting the guys who are good fits like that stay once he trades for them.
All right, well, there we go. That was our list. So I feel like I've learned a lot in this discussion, certainly, and it's always great to have your perspective that's coming from inside the locker room and talking to a variety of people around the organization on all these things that we're only observing from the outside.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm happy to share, man. I really do feel like, honestly, a lot of the messaging, though, is really public. I mean, some of the player stuff, obviously, everyone doesn't get privy to, but like, John does a good job. I really feel like he does a bad job at a lot of things, but I feel like one thing he does a really good job of is making clear what the vision is for the team. Like that seems to never, that's why I was so surprised. People were like, oh, Mike, we had a great year. I'm like, you're citing Vegas win totals. John don't give a damn. Jody don't care about what Vegas said, 7.5 and you won 9. Jody don't care. John don't care. They don't do that stuff in the building. They have a standard, you know, and John does a really good job of reinforcing that every year, making it clear, like, we're trying to win. We're here to win, you know. Like I said, 2022 may be the only year I'd be like, I hope we win. I don't know. We'll see. Because Gino played exponentially better than they thought. So
yeah,
it just kind of caught them by surprise. Charles and Abe both popped in the same year. You know, like, how likely was all that happening, you know? But yeah, I think I do feel like I have a lot of institutional knowledge too, but mostly just like a lot of it's just it's really getting to know the players, talking to a lot of assistants. But yeah, organizationally too, like I feel like they've all done a good job, whether they talk to them formally or just in passing or at the games. I make it very clear, like, yo, they're trying to win, man. They're trying to win. Like they don't feel like they need to take a step back. I feel like they can compete with anyone. And for a while there, I could see they can convince themselves, but I feel like this last year, going 3-6 at the crib and what some of them losses look like, I hope that was the wake-up call to be like, hey, we're a lot further away than we think, which I don't think that'll happen. I think they'll actually be like, oh, a couple games here. I even heard John say it on the radio. It was just like, yeah, man, you know, the Giants game, first Rams game, when you're like, yeah, I hear you, but like the contenders don't have those problems.
Yeah.
You know, Mike Sando put it a really good way. It was just like the Seahawks and Steelers are in the same boat. They win, but they're winning, but not contending. I was like, yes, perfect way to put it. Yeah. Cause there's a difference. There's a difference. Like the Commanders are contending. The Eagles are contenders. The Lions, even though they're not in the championship round, are contenders. The Ravens are contenders. The Bills are contenders. Chiefs, obviously. If you're scoreboard watching to get into the playoffs, you are probably not a contender.
Yep.
You know, like that's just kind of the reality of it. Like if you're scoreboard watching to get like home field, probably a contender, you know? So I hope they see it the way they should, man, because there's a version of this team that contends in 2025. But it requires a really honest assessment of the roster. Like really, really honest. Like let's not just only see the best versions of all of our players. Like let's be real here. Like some of our guys were vet minimums for a reason. Some of our guys are fifth round picks for a reason. Like the last couple of years, they've been like looking at the roster and being like, well, if everybody plays to the potential we see in them, we'll be great. And I'm just like, okay, great. You know, If I was five, if I was 7 feet, 7 inches tall, I'd be in the NBA. You know, like it don't really work like that. So, happy to rant on the show anytime you guys need me.
Yeah, we'll be calling you again soon for sure. We will be back later in the week with our usual regular pod. And until then, thanks so much, Mike Sean, and thank you for listening.
Thank you. This is awesome.
Appreciate you guys, as always.